will be planted. So what example we can give over here is the namaz, what you're reciting right now, will act as a seed for your hereafter. The tree of this seed, the tree of this namaz, can be seen in the hereafter, in paradise.
All right.
In this way, when you're connecting the worldly example to the hereafter, the child will understand, okay, now the namaz which I'm going to recite, I'm going to see its tree in the hereafter, in paradise, meaning its rewards, basically. Mm-hmm. The other example, what we can give is about the pocket money.
Mm-hmm.
So today we are going to give them some amount, like after a month, some other amount. So we are going to give them a few coins, example. And at the end of the day, if it's his birthday, example, he's going to purchase or she's going to purchase a gift for themselves, isn't
right.
it? The child is going to purchase a gift and the joy is different at another level.
Yeah.
Okay, with my pocket money, I have brought this thing, example.
Yeah.
So this is the very thing we can act, like we can take it as an example for our kids in order to tell them, okay, the namaz which you have recited in your whole life, okay?
Yeah.
Imagine the reward being given to you all at once, at one place.
Yeah.
The huge, immense reward, when you're going to see it, you'll forget all the troubles, all the worries, all the struggle which you have taken,
mm-hmm.
in all the struggle, whatever, like in whatever situation you have recited namaz, will be definitely seen in the hereafter. And of
right.
course, from different narrations, the positive effects of reciting namaz, I'm just talking about namaz.
Right.
There are many other things like fasts, hijab, khums, example, sadaqat,
mm-hmm.
amr bil maruf, nahi anil munkar. There are many other things. The very belief, the love towards the Ahlul Bayt, the tears towards the masaib or towards the sorrows of Ahlul Bayt.
Mm-hmm.
Everything has its
Count.
Effect in this world, for
right.
sure. And also the hereafter. But the thing is, as for the believers, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will show its effects in a lower scale in this world in order to preserve more for the hereafter.
And where we need it, actually.
Exactly.
We have
yes.
this from Imam Sadiq al-Islam, that when a person will see the rewards of the sufferings in the hereafter, they will say, I wish I had scissors and I cut myself into pieces in the world again so that I see more
of
rewards,
the rewards.
Hey.
Yep. Yes, it is indeed. It is indeed like this. And another example is the story of Prophet Ayyub alayhi salam,
mm-hmm.
and his patience. So basically, because of his patience, when he was troubled with all the disease, with the loss of his kids, the loss of his children, the loss
right.
of his property, at the end of the day, he was granted more than what he has lost.
Yeah.
So with patience comes rewards. So
indeed, even for the, like, the, I would say, for the prophets who were the, very close than us to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, they have had so many sufferings and they
the prophets,
received
the
rewards
Bayt.
Later
yes,
on.
Yes, indeed.
And they were shown the taste of patience.
And the 12th Imam, the example of a 12th Imam.
Right,
imagine,
indeed.
Like, one day when he comes, everything will change. The
yes.
world will be filled with justice. Yeah, and
the way it's filled with injustice.
Indeed,
and we are indeed waiting for that time.
Sure.
Thank you so much for
Thank
being
you.
With us. Thank you, dear listeners. That was all the time we had for today's episode. Until another episode, take good care. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Out of
purpose of praising Allah, to glorify Allah. O mountains of Mecca, what can you tell of the day that stones from the sky fell, destroying an army determined to break the house of Allah that Abraham built. O mountains of Mecca, how was the dawn on the day that my prophet Muhammad was born? How did it feel knowing he was to be the last and most beloved of all, Rasul of Allah, Nabi of Allah? O mountains of Mecca, you were there when the prophet Muhammad climbed down in despair. Engraved in his heart were the words of his Lord to all of mankind. This was his call: La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. O people, praise only Allah, glorify
Bazaar.
The construction industry has continuously had a series of revolutions throughout history, Technological advancements have influenced the construction sector too, from durable concrete in ancient structures to smart windows that automatically open and close based on light exposure. Some materials evolved with time, others are new to the industry and address natural disasters while reflecting changing lifestyles and environmental values. Still, other materials are born out of a need to reduce construction costs. In a nutshell, structures and their materials are the building blocks of society and economic expansion. Hello everyone, Ali Reza here, welcoming you to a brand new edition of Bazaar. This week, we are taking you on a journey through Iran's mammoth building construction industry while highlighting some of the country's recent developments in this sector. Plus, we will check out its market as a whole and the construction industry's contributions to the national economy. So, let's get started. To understand the enormity of the construction industry, we visited the 22nd Annual International Building and Construction Exhibition in Tehran. Because the exhibition was sprawled over nearly 4 hectares of land, one day is not nearly enough for visitors to see the entire expo, so it ran for 3 days. This exhibition is one of the most important events in its industry. We caught up with a few companies at the exhibit to see what they were offering. Our first stop was at a booth held by a company that makes ceramic tiles. They also export their products to numerous countries. Next, we stopped by a company specializing in manufacturing faucets and kitchen and bathroom attachments. It also purchases most of its raw materials from inside the country. Like many we have seen at the event, this company has created many job opportunities directly and indirectly. Plus, it uses the latest machinery to make high-quality products that compete with foreign brands. All things considered, the construction sector has been significant for the Iranian economy. The sector is divided into two main parts: government infrastructure projects and the housing industry. The construction industry has been thriving due to national and international investment to the extent that it is now one of the largest in the West Asia region. This sector suffered a lot after the U.S. withdrew from the 2015 deal and reimposed sanctions against Iran. These measures choked construction materials imports. As a result, the steady flow of things like metals to Iran was seriously hampered and eventually halted altogether. But despite the bans, this industry continues to grow and is also one of the few that exports services to other countries. Based on the Association of Iranian Exports of Technical and Engineering Services, Iran currently has the potential to export engineering services worth $40 billion annually. The country already exports these services to countries around the Caspian Sea, its bordering neighbors, South and Central America, North Africa, and South Asia. Some construction projects include sewage treatment plants, dams, and energy plants. According to the Ministry of Industry, Mining, and Trade, Iran is self-sufficient in construction material production. Steel, glass, and cement are abundantly produced in the country. Moreover, the surplus of these items is exported to countries worldwide. Government officials say they have plans to expand exports to Iran's trade partners, including China and Russia. For example, the Ministry of Industry, Mine and Trade says it plans to sell upwards of $3 billion worth of construction materials to Russia alone. As a whole, the government views the construction sector as a feasible alternative for generating foreign revenues and diversifying the country's economy away from oil profits. That wraps up our program for today. Also, if you have a topic that you're interested in, you can send us your thoughts and suggestions via email. We always enjoy hearing from you. On behalf of the entire team, thank you for tuning in. Until then, take care and bye-bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
The following is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with school and university students. The meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayhi Husayniyah on November 3, 2025, on the eve of Student Day and the National Day of Fighting Global Arrogance.
There may be a time when a government, a person, a group, or an aggressor considers itself to be superior to others and grants itself the right to push others around, to encroach upon the vital interests of others, and to dictate terms to others. Arrogance in this form is bad. A government, for instance, it was the British government in one era, and it's the US today, grants itself the right to establish, for example, 10 military bases in a certain country that lacks a strong government or an aware populace to create facilities for itself, to take their oil, to seize their interests, and to plunder their underground resources. This is istikbar. This is the arrogance we object to, the arrogance we speak about, and the arrogance we chant slogans against. So our country was faced with the arrogance of the US government. Before the World War II, the US government wasn't one that meddled in the affairs of others. After World War II, the US government became an arrogant power in the sense that I just described, where it was seizing control everywhere, interfering everywhere, intruding everywhere, and imposing its own interests over those of other nations wherever its interests dictated. They would use any means necessary. Sometimes this was done with anger and scowls, sometimes with a smile, sometimes with force, and sometimes using bribery. Well, this is what the US is like. As a matter of fact, during that period, the period our discussion is focused on, around 1977, 1978, and that time, the US found itself facing the Islamic Republic following the victory of the revolution. Of course, we Iranians weren't strangers to the US's conduct. It wasn't as though we were unfamiliar with its arrogant nature. We knew what the US was like since the 28th of Mordad, August 19th, 1957. The 28th of Mordad was a major event. Let me say just one thing about it. Even today, many people still don't understand or realize the significance of the 28th of Mordad coup and the devastating blow it dealt to Iran. They only know the 28th of Mordad as the date when a coup took place.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all.
Seven skies, see a pure heart never lies. The words you learn will never earn. It's time to think and wonder why. Stars above will always be a shining guide for us to see. And when I doubt, I'll have no doubt, but still I wonder why. The
Good night to all our listeners. You are tuned into Iran Radio broadcasting from Tehran, and I'm your presenter for the next hour. We start this hour's lineup with Spotlight, a daily program which covers the most important events happening in the world today. And we round up this hour's programs with our varied radio productions feature. Stay with us for the next hour.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, since the start of the latest round of Israeli genocide in Gaza in October of 2023, the regime is also wreaking havoc in the West Bank. Increased murders, raids, demolitions, and kidnappings have become the norm. All of this while the illegal settlement building has been expedited. And Palestinians not only have to deal with the violence inflicted on them by the IOF, but also the attacks by settlers against themselves and their homes and land. Life has been disrupted by checkpoints, which have been exponentially increased since the start of the Gaza genocide. Well, stay with us as we take a look at the occupied West Bank on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guest to the program, Syed Moaz Shah, international law expert and geopolitical analyst out of Geneva. And Syed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator out of London. Well, thank you both for being with me. I'll start this off in Geneva. And Syed Moaz, I mean, in your perspective, why has the regime increased the oppression in the West Bank at the same time as its ongoing genocide is taking place in Gaza? It is almost as if it felt that people's attention was more on Gaza, and it could basically get away with doing whatever it wanted to.
Well, thank you for having me, and I think you said it well. They're trying to always look for a window, but they have their project, their occupational project that we know that's going to continue. I mean, we have many commentators already telling that this ceasefire is more you cease and we'll still fire, and we have repeatedly seen that. I mean, just the latest waves of attacks, drones were being used as well, not just in Gaza, but also in the West Bank. This has been an old Israeli strategy. It's always going to be there. It's not like something that was unexpected. It's the same project, the occupation, the destabilization of the region, and take away Palestinian rights, be they in the West Bank or Gaza. This is nothing surprising. So I don't see this as any different than an Israeli policy that's been going on. The pressure that was going on in respect to Gaza was very high before the ceasefire. The idea was that maybe it was a public show to show this 20-point plan, and there was a small window of hope. But we all knew that if the fundamentals don't change, and the fundamentals of the Zionist regime are not going to change, not with the Netanyahu in place, not with this government, and I don't see any change in that.
Well, Syed Mohsen, I mean, at least 65,000 people have been displaced in Jenin and Turcom during this period. I mean, your thoughts, on the one hand, we have been watching, unfortunately, regularly in Gaza, the displacement, the destruction of homes, but also the destruction of infrastructure. Parts have been taking place in the West Bank, too. Now, looking at this, 65,000 people have been displaced there. Your thoughts?
The playbook is the same as ever, really, isn't it? They have something called Greater Israel, which they're adamant they will own. It includes not just, of course, Palestine, but it goes far beyond, as far as the Euphrates and beyond, and as far as the Sinai Desert. So this is a reality. It's not some kind of pie in the sky. They are operating on the policy of creating the Greater Israel. And the first thing that must fall for Greater Israel to really catch hold is West Bank. I mean, they're openly talking about Judea and Samaria, that they're only talking about it, that region in those terms. They haven't stopped the settlements. They have expanded settlements in the West Bank ever since the wiping out of Gaza, essentially. And at the moment, what we're seeing is that they're getting more and more desperate. There are reports of failed operations. They called it the Five Stones operation, the latest one that I picked up on. And the Palestinian resistance has been doing really admirably. They've actually been fighting back, disabling D9 military bulldozers and advancing along the Wadi al-Tayassir axis after targeting it. It had been targeted by the Tufan ground explosive device. So there's a lot of response. And the Israelis had said they would break through by destroying the fighters that were there. They started off by, I think, assassinating certain people, Yusuf Asasa and Al-Muntasir Billah Abdullah. These are just two people in Jenin that I've come across in the reports. But they aren't having an easy ride of it because, of course, the Palestinian Jihad and others are in all of these areas are still strong and they're still fighting and they're still capable of giving Israel a bloody nose. But they are the front line of preventing a greater Israel.
Okay, well, I mean, the regime, said Muaz, almost seems like it's operating in fast forward, trying to inflict as much pain as possible, trying to usurp as much land and property as fast as they can, while at the same time exerting mental and physical torture to the Palestinians. I mean, tell me about, what is their goal here? Is it basically just to torture them, or is it basically their goal to rid the West Bank of Palestinians?
You know, it actually, the Amnesty International came out just earlier this week, and they basically answered that question for us. Is it's a genocide. The genocidal intent is still, as per Amnesty International's latest report, a serious allegation against Israel. So this is not just about the ethnic cleansing or seizing of land. This is genocidal intent. When we talk about over 6,500 tons of aid that was supposed to go in a month's time that was blocked. When we talk about 16,000 Palestinians who need essential medical care to survive are prevented from getting those supplies, you basically want them to die. When we talk about the relentless bombings almost every day, where is this ceasefire? There are almost 750 essential medicines, and they're already out of nearly 400 of those essential medicines there. So when you are putting these roadblocks in, preventing these supplies from coming in, you clearly have a genocidal intent. And as per international law, when you affect the livability of life in this way, you can be charged with this intent. And imagine this is with a ceasefire, supposedly.
Well, so let's look at the Said Moss. Let's look at, you're talking about Gaza, but let's look at the West Bank itself. I mean, there are those that say that there's also an intent of genocide, an ethnic cleansing there too. I mean, how do you see that?
Well, of course, this seems to be taken collectively as a whole. It's not like the Gaza Palestinian is somehow for the Israeli less valuable than the West Bank. For them, they're all the same. I mean, they're one Palestinians that do not deserve basic human rights, and we're seeing that in continuous actions. We've seen that report that came last week about the two Palestinians who surrendered, and while they were surrendering, they were shot dead and for no reason. And then they tried to cover that up. And this has been the impunity that has continued to go on because there has been no serious check and balance. There's been an attempt by international organizations to document this because these soldiers are actually putting some of this material on social media. And that is having some impact. But the level that we need to see is some serious international repercussions against these war crimes that are being committed. And until we actually see that, this impunity will continue. The Israeli government is not going to stop. The soldiers have been given that. I mean, they're still thinking in their minds, this is Amalek, and we need to destroy them and remove them and uproot them and take over greater Israel, as right. My fellow has indicated. So this is West Bank, Gaza. It's the same genocidal intent that's continuing forth And it's unfortunate until the international community raises the bar on checking Israel's impunity, we can't get. I mean, just one small point. Just recently, there was a General Assembly on motion on resolution on torture. And guess which are the states that voted against it? America, Argentina, and Israel. So, I mean, it clearly shows that they are not in any mood to seriously cooperate with the international community to bring human rights to the Palestinians.
Yeah, well, speaking of the international community, I mean, it said most since 2023, at least 18,500 Palestinians have been arrested in the West Bank. This includes children and women, and currently there are 10,800 in jail. These figures are astronomical. And again, speaking of that international community, we don't hear much about this severe abuse of human rights, nor do we hear condemnations of this. I mean, your thoughts about this side of the kind of pressure that the Palestinians are under?
Well, you know, they call Israelis hostages, don't they? And the Palestinians are basically, you know, prisoners. The reality is the Palestinians from the West Bank who've been abducted ever since the Nakba, numbers well over 1 million. That's the official figure. This year it topped 1 million, the number of people from the West Bank and Gaza who just picked up, abducted essentially, kidnapped under no real rule of law and are slammed into prisons. And lately we've seen the cases of rape are just coming out, cases of torture and violence. It's really sick. I mean, if you go and do the studies in detail on the way that Palestinian prisoners have been treated, it's one of the worst forms of crimes that you could think of on the planet. Actually, sick individuals with real psychological issues given a full license to do what they like to people they regard as animals and beasts, locked away behind closed doors where there are no cameras. You can just imagine what goes on. You see what they do in public. So what they've been doing to these people from West Bank and the hostages that they've been taking, over 10,000, as you say, some said 13,000 not so long ago, you know, it's beyond criminal. It's barbaric, but the world is still silent about that. They're not really, those human rights organizations are doing very little. There's no way, no sanctions on the way these prisoners are, on these prisons or the people who supply services to those prisons or even the Western establishment which trains and also supplies various items to these. Nothing. There's been nothing like that going on, and that's where a lot of the attack should go on in terms of trying to prevent not just arms, but stopping the torture that goes on inside these prisons. And of course, West Bank folk have been killed en masse, although the figures in Gaza now, I mean, my figures are 680,000, up to 680,000 have been killed either by famine, direct murder, torture, whatever it means you want to put it, cholera. Those figures are not down there where everybody's talking, where they're saying they're 70,000 or 100,000. They're way beyond, and those figures will come out. Outfits like the Lancet and others have been giving strong indications along that line. But it's also been happening in the West Bank. West Bank hasn't been highlighted because the scale of the murders and the tortures hasn't been quite as much as the Gazan situation.
Let me just jump in here, said Mohsen, but at the same time, if this was in any other place in the world, because yes, comparatively, it's definitely not as much as Gaza. But when we look at the situation, what is taking place in the West Bank, I mean, if it was happening in a Western city, a Western town, there would be total outrage. And yet we see the Israeli regime continuing with their very unbelievable scale of violence, very callous-like, but at the same time, these Western governments are supporting them. I mean, what do you make of this? It's absolute insanity.
Well, the moral relativism and the sickness that exists within the Western establishment particularly, and many people who still haven't bought into the reality of what's going on in Palestine, is really mind-boggling. But what they do is the minute one person gets terrorized or attacked, it's major headlines here, of course, and world leaders will gather and there'll be all sorts of condemnations. If it was an Israeli, for instance, the incident up in Manchester, we can't hear the last of it. You know, a couple of Jewish folk were attacked, we think under a psychological operation. It was either some kind of false flag or Black Swan operation. They made such a big deal that the media here in Britain doesn't stop talking about it. There'll be memorial days and goodness knows what. Whereas, you know, the lives of brown Muslim Palestinians don't matter. It's racism. There is clear racism there within the general media narrative. And there's also this dumbing down amongst the society, much as I'd like to commend all those demonstrators who turn up, and there is a strong support for Palestine on the ground now. But in practical terms, that doesn't really change or affect the British establishment's policy, which is fundamentally racist, imperialist, colonialist, and they deliberately play down and dehumanize the plight of the Palestinians, and they very much humanize the Israelis, who are the actual perpetrators of the oppression and the violence.
Hmm. Well said, Moaz. I mean, as the oppression increases, so do reprisal attacks. Now, let's look at that, because would you say that since 2023, that there has been a rise in the number of resistance fighters, even, as it is a natural reaction to this oppression?
Absolutely. I mean, when you don't give hope, obviously the people then have no other way but to resist. And this is something that the Palestinian people are very well known for, and they will continue in this tradition until they see some really green light at the end of the tunnel, which unfortunately it's a very dark tunnel and the light seems very far. The ceasefire was supposed to be an opening opportunity, but unfortunately when you have insincere people who do not, I mean, who actually try to attempt to kill mediators while they're trying to work on a solution, it clearly shows you they're not interested in that. I mean, just one, I keep trying to tell people just a sense of reflection, and this also shows something about the resilience of the Palestinian people. Look how they treated the hostages and prisoners, and compare that to the bodies that they're receiving and their Palestinian prisoners that are being released, emaciated, the bodies they received. Not one body is without torture marks. I mean, this is just absolutely ridiculous. Calling itself a democracy in the Middle East, the only democracy in the Middle East, and acting like this, then obviously the people will say, we don't want this type of democracy. We're going to have our own system, and we're going to seek it. And regardless, you know, if the world gets behind Palestine or not, Palestine is going to fight this out. And that's been the call of the Palestinian people. So I don't see that going away. And Israel, you know, clearly you see from its actions, it's beyond just the Palestinians. I mean, they're in Lebanon and Syria and the neighboring countries. Their impunity is reaching new heights. So this is something, like I said, from the Palestinians, expect resistance until they get the state. This is something that I don't think the Palestinians would ever give up. Doesn't matter if the world is with them or not.
Well said, Mohsen. Would you say that with the increased violence by the regime, in reality, it will expedite the pressure on itself, because Palestinians will respond to the oppression, and ultimately this will backfire on the Zionists. Your thoughts?
It's a losing game. Israel has got people leaving the country. The latest reports were they were piling up outside the Portuguese embassy in Tel Aviv, desperate to get out of Israel. There's a climate now of fear, and there's a climate of insecurity, which the Israeli government, no matter what it does, will not be able to allay. I mean, the Yemenis, of course, was firing ballistic missiles regularly. The Iranians penetrated all the defense systems. And and leaving aside those bigger powers, the Israelis can't seem to handle a small force of Palestinian resistance fighters and have taken 2 years to just get round to clearing up a load of, creating a load of rubble and killing lots of poor civilians, innocent civilians. That's what their achievement is. And what they're doing is they're riding at the moment on the back of America. And I have to talk about the complicity of the United Nations Security Council here. China and Russia didn't veto this preposterous supposed peace deal, which Trump has got in place. But what the Israelis are now doing is saying, okay, we've got this side of it under control. It's kind of resolved up to the point where, you know, we've got the Palestinians where we want them in Gaza, essentially. And now, how about we start creating our dream of Judea and Samaria? Let's start clearing out the West Bank. And of course, part of that tactic is by exponentially raising the number of settlements. You know, the area of West Bank now is so peppered with these settlements that it's impossible really to call it a Palestinian territory or a Palestinian Authority-run region, because actually Israel, of course, puppeteers the Palestinian Authority And Abbas obliges as the puppet that he is. And as far as the people's plight on the ground goes, they can't squeak because it's Israeli security forces combined with these Palestinian Authority traitors, as far as I'm concerned. They have them hemmed in. And still, amongst, within that, you have those areas, even in Hebron, in of course, in Jenin, etc., these areas, there's still resistance. And so that bodes well, because the Palestinian resistance still hasn't buckled after all of the might of the US and the Israeli armed forces has been raining down hell on it for the last 2 years, then I don't see much future for the success of that that sort of ethnic cleansing, killing, murder, and genocidal policy. They just are on a losing wicket. They know it, and I think that internally there are fragmentations which will emerge even more powerfully, and there may be even a possibility that in the end the backers of Israel will be themselves forced to find some sort of compromise, some sort of solution. What that will be should be for the Palestinians to decide, but of course the colonialist imperialists are trying to impose their kind of rule of law over this region,
right.
And they will fail, just like they failed before.
Well, Said Muaz, your prognosis, where do you think the situation is going in the West Bank?
Well, I think my fellow colleague spoke very accurately. One of the things we don't talk about much is the internal collapse that's happening in Israeli society. I mean, look at Netanyahu just this week. He's trying to save his skin still. And I have always said this, that like 2 years before this October 2023 attack by Israel on Gaza, he's doing this to protect his own skin, to deflect from the corruption charges and bribery and going to jail, essentially. And he's been fueling this conflict as also in a personal interest. Another note that we must know in Israeli society, not only are they trying to run out of the country, they're beginning to actually feel the mental pressure and strain. We see hundreds of cases of PTSD of these soldiers obviously committing these war crimes. It has a mental effect, and that's exploding and spilling all over Israeli social media. So you're beginning to now see massive amounts of people come out and just refuse to join the forces of IDF. So I hope that this further continues, and to be honest, I think an internal collapse of the Israeli society domestically will be the breaking point. And Netanyahu and his this cronies, they're creating the environment for that. They're going to destroy Israel themselves. This is the truth.
All right. Said Mohsen, your thoughts. You think it's going to come from within the side of the Israeli entity, an implosion from within, or the role that you see, for example, of Palestinian resistant groups playing in all of this?
Israel as a brand is toxic now. Everybody knows in the world that it is a heartless, cold, psychopathic society. And I don't ascribe to just being it being their establishment, because 90% of the statistics are in favor of genocides and ethnic cleansing, 70 to 90% every time you look at the stats. The Israeli society supports these things. They support the rapists, for instance, who were raping the prisoners from the West Bank who were being kept, or prisoners from Gaza. And of course, a society which is sick enough to want to support the rapists and to condemn those who were raped clearly tells you what the state of that nation is. And in reality, they have no more mileage in terms of global opinion, that's for sure. The leaders hopefully will become more and more pressurized and will have to also start loosening their support for Israel or finding some other ways out. But in the end, I think Israel from the get-go was a project that just couldn't be, wasn't sustainable. And now, even if the Saudis and all the Arabs were to go along with recognizing the situation that Trump wants them to, in terms of completely destroying the armed resistance of Palestinians and completely turning it into Rivieras and whatever else he's got on his mind. The fact is, the people, they underestimate the people of Palestine, and they underestimate their attachment to that land, and they underestimate their, you know, indomitable spirit, but they just won't let go. And I agree with Said Muaz. And I think that in the end is the spirit of the Palestinians, and that the Israelis' own self-destruction will bring it to its knees.
And on that note, thank you both for being with me. Said Muaz Shah, international law expert and geopolitical analyst out of Geneva, and Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator out of London. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
hustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
That was the week that was. Beyond the headlines, we dissect the stories that shaped the past 7 days, from the heart of region to the global stage. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Hello, dear listeners. Welcome to our political chat show, That Was the Week, That Was. We look at global politics and issues of the day, and I'm your host, Leila Garcia. With me here in the studio is veteran journalist and political commentator, Miranda Akhshand. Please stay tuned. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks very much indeed.
Today's discussion is about Donald Trump banning South Africa from G20 summit over alleged human rights abuse. President Trump has banned South Africa from attending next year's G20 summit for what he characterizes as human rights abuses leading to the slaughter of white people. The United States did not attend the G20 summit in South Africa because the South African government refuses to acknowledge or address the horrific human rights abuses endured by Afrikaners and other descendants of Dutch, French, and German settlers. President Trump wrote on social media, "Therefore, at my direction, South Africa will not be receiving an invitation to the 2026 G20 meeting, which will be hosted in the great city of Miami, Florida, next year." The Trump administration has long accused the South African government of allowing minority white Afrikaner farmers to be persecuted and attacked, as it restricted the number of refugees admitted annually to the U.S. to 7,500. The administration indicated that most will be white South Africans who it claimed faced discrimination and violence at home. But the government of South Africa has said it is surprised by the accusation of discrimination because white people in the country generally have a much higher standard of living than its black residents. Okay, let's bring in veteran journalist and political commentator Miranda Akhshand.
It's nice to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
My first question is, has there been a genocide of white South Africans as Donald Trump has claimed?
Well, actually, none of South Africa's political parties, including those that represent Afrikaners or the white community in South Africa, have claimed that there is currently a genocide going on in South Africa. In fact, President Trump's claim was described as nonsense by John Steenhuisen, the leader of South Africa's second biggest political party, the Democratic Alliance. And Steenhuisen is also the Minister of Agriculture in the coalition government led by President Cyril Ramaphosa. And also, Jacob Kleinhans, a senior official in the Afrikaner lobby group Solidarity, said he has told the American government that there is no genocide in South Africa and there is no government seizure of land belonging to white South Africans. So, unfortunately, such claims have been circulating among right-wing or extreme right-wing groups for many years now. And even in his first term in office, President Trump referred to the large-scale killing of white farmers in South Africa, and that was in his first term in office.
Yeah.
So some white farmers actually have been killed in South Africa. South Africa does have a very high murder rate.
Yeah.
But there's also a lot of misleading information about this on the internet. In February of this year, a South African judge dismissed the idea of a genocide as clearly imagined and not real when ruling in an inheritance case involving a wealthy benefactor's donation to white supremacist group, the Boer Legion.
Right.
South Africa does not release crime figures based on race, but in May of this year, South Africa's police minister, Senzo Mchunu, gave a breakdown of killings on farms in South Africa in order to debunk claims about genocide in the country.
Yeah.
So the South African police minister, Senzo Mchunu, said between January and March of this year, 5 out of 6 people killed on farms in South Africa were black, and just one of them was white.
Right.
The white victim lived on a farm, while the black people who were killed comprised of 2 farm owners, 2 employees, and 1 farm manager. So I can say that claims of a white genocide in South Africa have been repeatedly dismissed by the South African government and South African officials, by independent judges and international media, and these claims have been dismissed as either imaginary or not real. So the South African government has totally rejected